So that, you know, what it said to me is that how you recruit people, the expectations that you give them, the training that you give them. My greatest success here at CMA has been being able to find good people and creating an environment, having the latitude, the resources to create an environment within which those people can function effectively. And that's totally different than it ever was, and totally different than most other organizations in this town.
Well, that I would like to talk a little bit about your pre-CMA time, but that, I'd like to hold that thought, because part of what we've been talking about in our other interviews is this whole idea of creativity and how you nurture that and how you foster people to be creative and innovative, and what atmosphere is conducive to that and what's restrictive. Or maybe we should, while we're in that mode, why don't we just continue with that thought for a little bit as to how do you encourage people to be innovative and creative?
I use the term environment. One of the conditions of my taking this job 17, 18 years ago was that this kind of a facility be constructed. Where we were was not conducive to doing the job that needed to be done. The greatest illustration of that was that the leadership of the industry did not meet in the building. The leadership of the industry always met in Washington in a hotel. Okay, they would meet in the Madison Hotel, they would meet in the Mayflower, they would meet in some nice property. Never met in the headquarters building. And for good reason. It was a dump. It was pitiful. And I was particularly mindful of this. And I want you to know that in my previous 21 years at National Paint and Coatings Association, I constructed the model for what I brought to MCA/CMA. Much of what I did do here, I had tested there, had started there, had constructed to a large degree there. It was the chemical company supplier members of NPCA who knew Bob Rowland and knew that MCA needed to be reformed, who brought me here. DuPont, Dow, Monsanto, Carbide, those people knew, they were all members.
Okay.
Over at the Paint Association as suppliers. They were my board members. Dick Heckert was on my board. Okay, a lot of those people were on my board over there. So they could see that the things that were being done at little old paint and coatings were the kinds of things that ought to be done for the big chemical industry but weren't being done. Right, back to the question. When they hired me, I insisted that we be interviewed. I'd be interviewed over there because it was a beautiful old mansion. You've never seen it, but it's very historic. It was the Bell Morton Mansion. It was the vice president's home. It was is a magnificent edifice. And people would say, boy, you live pretty good. This is a heck of a lot better than my office back at the factory. I said, precisely, because we're not selling paint. We're selling beauty. We're not selling raw materials, we're selling finished goods. A look. I said, this building should reflect what the coatings industry, the decorative products industry is all about. And I said, the fact that we are able to do that is an advantage. The other thing was, I started there on the concept of involvement, member involvement. There was a very popular feeling as association management became more of a profession, not just a skill. And this was back in the 60s primarily. The concept of the hired gun became very popular. That you hired some smart guy to represent your industry. Now in the old days, they hired generals and admirals and ex-congressmen and senators because they knew it all, which is bull hockey. they didn't know it all. They knew parts of government. They knew how to access. And most of them were very bad managers, okay? And most of their organizations weren't all that effective, unless you were operating under wartime conditions for allocations and that kind of thing. As we got into the 60s and this increase in government control, regulation, legislation, environmental, consumer activities, all of the big government concepts coming to bear, it was necessary that you have qualified people, very qualified people, in order to meet that kind of a challenge. The hired gun wasn't the answer. It would work for a while. And a lot of people thought that, okay, I'll speak for the industry. I'll be the czar. I'll be the commissioner. And the truth of the matter is, it works to a degree. If nobody is representing the industry, that's better than nothing. But what people really want is for the industry to manifest itself. Congressmen and senators and presidents and what have you don't want to talk to a hired administrator. They want to talk to a CEO of a company. Conversely, if you are going to effectively represent your industry, you must know what that industry believes and what they think. Now, when I was first hired, I wrote down, I'm sorry I didn't bring it with me because I have it, on a yellow fool's cap, some 15 items. And I went to my first executive committee and I read those 15 items. One of those 15 items was to change the name from MCA to CMA. And people said, well, why? And it was not an easy thing to do, I will tell you. It's the closest to a public hanging that these people have been in a long time. I said, all right, you are Senator Kennedy, and you are now going to regulate the chemical industry, or you're concerned about something in the chemical industry. Now, you don't know squat about the chemical industry. You don't know squat about anything. So you go to your staff guy and you say, we're going to have hearings on this chemical regulation bill, and what I want you to do is get me some chemical people in here. So this guy, who, you know, is a political science major from Harvard, he doesn't know anything either, so what's he going to do? He has to find some place to go if he doesn't know who all the company. Oh, sure, there's DuPont, there's Dow, but who else and what else and how do we organize it and what have you. So they want to talk to the chemical industry from the phone book. If you looked in the phone book for something about the chemical industry, would you look under M or would you look under C? I would look under C. Okay, so now the second thing is, manufacturing chemists, and you've got a logo with this beaker and things, you know, and people holding stuff up to the light, you know, and brown bottles. I said, doesn't that give you the image of somebody working in a remote back room laboratory, some mystique kind of thing? Not what the products of the industry really are. I said, Chemical Manufacturers Association. What's that say? It says we represent chemical manufacturers, and that's what we ought to be. I said, it's that simple to me. Now, the reason why they came looking for somebody was because they had been badly beaten on the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA. They got badly beaten. And they got badly beaten because, one, they weren't organized. They really didn't know advocacy. Two, they were not organized personally and professionally. And three, they had no organization to go out and represent them and to build the staff support for these people. They fought all the time, and they did what they normally did. They said, well, okay, Dow believes this, and DuPont believes that, and Carbide believes this, and somebody else, Shell, believes that. Charlie, you're the CEO of this company. You're going to be the chairman of this committee. You're going to organize our TSCA thing. And right away, the other five guys are saying, that's a son of a bitch. He's never going to represent me, and he's never going to do it right, da-da-da-da-da-da. This was a climate. This is part of the environment that I talk about. Well, you had a bad physical environment. You had a bad professional environment. You had a bad membership environment. You had a bad everything environment. Nothing was working. And nobody had any goals or objectives. So, one of the first things I said was, we're going to change the name. We're going to get a flag that we can all march behind. And a flag that says to all of those guys out there who are looking for us, here we are. Here we are. You want to talk chemicals? Come see us. Now, the risk is, you got your flag. What do you have under the flag? How are you going to deal with these people? What, idiots? Disorganized, everybody talking for himself, doing what they want to do? We're going to have to find out how to organize ourselves under this flag. You come to town, your limos pick you up at the airport, drive you up to Connecticut Avenue, park outside this drugstore, go through this building with the hot dog smell, up to the second floor, mind you, not the 10th floor, which is a government office, but to the second floor. No air conditioning that functions. You open the windows and there's a bus stop down there. And all you hear is this vroom and the clouds. And you wouldn't stop there for 10 minutes. So you go meet at the Madison Hotel. I said, well, from now on, we're going to meet up here. Because I'll tell you something, we're moving. We need a headquarters building that reflects this industry and is a place that peer professionals can come to meet. The day I was interviewed in my office, my very elegant office, at National Paint and Coatings Association by John Henske on behalf of the board of directors. And I insisted that it be at that place. And I said, John, look around. What do you see? He says, this is very nice. I said, exactly. I said, why don't you meet in your own headquarters building? Well, it's not so nice. I said, how do you think your employees feel about it? Well, they don't like to go there. How do you think the staff feels about it? I said, I can tell you that. They hate it. There was a perimeter around a parking lot. It was a building that had a parking lot up through the middle of the building. And so all the offices were on an outside perimeter. And all the corridor doors were locked. Because when you got out of the parking lot, you could walk into any of the offices, and there were strangers there. And there was no way you could go from one office to the other around the perimeter other than going into this inner corridor and rushing like hell around there. Nobody knew anybody. And there were no meeting facilities. But I asked John a very important question. I said, John, what do you think the relationship between your staff and the staff of the association should be? And without a hesitation, he said, peer professional. I said, at that moment, you hired me. You hired me. So, how do you foster creativity and innovation? Number one, you create a physical environment within which people can operate, that they can meet. First thing I did when I started, got the industry behind us. I'll talk more about that. We leased this whole building, subleased the upper part. We took this. I constructed 15 conference rooms, furnished them as nicely as we could. All the offices waited. We did the conference rooms first because what we wanted to do was create a place where that peer professional relationship could happen, where the guys would go from their office to here and have a Coke, coffee, lunch served in the building. You know, they pay for it, but it's convenient for them. You need a telephone, it's here. You need a tape, it's here. You need a fax machine, you need something else, it's here. It's all state of the art that you need. You know, you want to. So after a couple of years, we got into this building. I never unpacked my boxes. My boxes stood against the wall in my office up on Connecticut Avenue. And every time a member came in, every time a staff member came in, they'd look at it and they'd say, aren't you ever going to unpack? I said, not here. I don't work here. I'll work somewhere else, but I won't work here. This is not where we're permanently going to be. All right, so we got that. Second thing was, how do you organize the people? People on the staff, I went into a staff meeting. I said, we're going to have a staff meeting every Monday morning. The vice presidents will all be here. this is the way it is. And I won't bore you with how many people I fired and how rapidly I did it. I did everything that was allowed under the law. But I got rid of a lot of dead wood. People that were sent to the association from member companies because they didn't know what to do with them. And they weren't doing the job. So I went out and started hiring young, smart, aggressive people. I went to the first staff meeting with the vice presidents, and we were talking about it. At that time, I think it was Superfund. I mean, Superfund has been my life. And staff was arguing about something. I said, wait a minute. What's the association's position on this? And they didn't know. I said, what's the staff's position on this? They didn't know. I said, fine. I'm leaving the meeting. When you guys decide what you think the position of this industry and this association should be, you come back and call me. And then I'll listen to you. And we'll see where we go from there. And that literally happened. I mean, literally. They were so disorganized, they didn't know what they wanted, much less what the members wanted. At this time, one of the major problems we had was Love Canal. And Love Canal was Hooker Chemical Company. And Hooker Chemical was persona non grata within MCA at that time. Don't remember the fellow's name, Jack something or other. And he had been on the executive committee. And he came down and visited with me and told me the story of Love Canal, showed me some of the papers. And I said, this is amazing. And clearly the case, which has been proven, that the city was at fault, the school district, by going in there and breaking the cap, and they had all the authority and all the legality behind them to put that dump there, and everybody knew it. These guys went in and turned it over, sold it to developers, broke the cap, and that's what caused the problem. The dumping of that sludge and stuff in there was legal at that time under the law of the state of New York and the county and city of Buffalo. So this was all bull hockey. Now, I was convinced enough as a lawyer and as a businessman that this was wrong. I carried that fight to the Wall Street Journal, which was the first newspaper to ever come out and say, hey, the industry was right here. It's the damn city and the school board that was wrong. And I took the papers up and sat down and showed them to them. But I went to the executive committee and I created an agenda one day at one of our meetings and I had Hooker come in. And the chairman of the executive committee said, why are you doing this? I said, it's very simple. There but for the grace of God goes every one of you guys around this table. I said, you just don't know. You can turn your back on Hooker, but you can't turn your back on this problem, and that's what you're doing. You're setting yourselves up for a great fall. So I had him come in. I just can't think of his name. When the meeting was over, he left, and the executive committee sat around and talked, and I told him exactly that. I said, gentlemen, there but for the grace of God go each and every one of you and your companies. I said, this is not how this organization should function. It's not how this industry should function. I said, we must support one another. We must decide policy. We must do the right thing. And we must do it as quickly and as publicly as we possibly can. Okay. The next thing was, your responsibility is to run this industry. You control it. It's not my job to do that. I manage the association for you. If John Henske's philosophy, belief, and mine of peer professionalism is going to happen, I need your best people working with my best people. And I need it in an environment where they can be creative and comfortable. And I need it with the understanding that you will support us. You will support us, not just financially, but philosophically, personally, by making policy, by doing the things that need to be done to carry this industry forward. I need your commitment. They were ready for that. In the synergism, the fortuity. I was there. I believed that I had tested it. They were there. They understood it. They believed it. Now, it didn't happen overnight. How much of this is all public record?
You control who has access to it. So there's release forms in which you can control it, so it's up to you. And
well,
you
have
the ultimate control over what we have.
The One of the most unique things in CMA is called the Greenbrier procedure. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard about it.
Okay. The Greenbrier procedure came about in this fashion. And what it is it's a statement in our yearbook. It's printed in the book. And it says that if you as a company or a member disagree with the position of CMA, you can publicly express yourself by writing to the president of the association. And the president of the association will arrange for you to bring your position before the board or executive committee of the association, at which time your position will be debated. And if you carry the day, fine. If you don't carry the day, then you cannot publicly say to the rest of the world that I am CMA and I disagree with them and blah, blah, blah. If you start that divisiveness within the organization, you're going to destroy it. And we only have, you know, a couple hundred members. So you can't afford to go down that path. The worst part of it is, though, what it does to your adversaries, what it does to your advocacy program. It fragments you in the eyes of the public, and once they divide you, they conquer you. So what you can do is say, I'm still a member of CMA, I still believe in CMA, I support CMA, I part company with them on this issue, my belief on this issue is as follows, the association's position will be stated by them. Okay? And you do not go out and badmouth the association. Because the next time, you know, it may be you who is in the majority and somebody else is in the minority. So let's hold this together. That came about because a member company went to Capitol Hill and one of their staff people started to cut a deal and created this kind of bifurcation, and it caused serious problem for our advocacy. When I found out this was going on, I found out which company it was. And I called the chairman of that company. And I said, your employee can no longer represent this association. He will no longer be in our committees. He is no longer welcome in this building. And I want you to know that's how strongly I feel about this. And I want you to know that you must do something about it. Otherwise, you're going to be persona non grata in the board of directors and executive committee. That man removed that employee from that function, came to Washington, and visited with all of my staff and apologized to them publicly for what one of his employees did. And it was just at that time that we were having a board meeting, an executive committee meeting at the Greenbrier. Bark Morley was the chairman of the executive committee, and I told him, I said, Bark, I've got my resignation in my pocket. I will not tolerate this. And I said, if I go, I'll take the rest of the staff with me. They won't tolerate it. I said, you don't send us out on a limb and then saw it off. We're not hired guns. Remember what we are? Remember how we run an association? And we had a closed meeting, and I ran a seminar for 2.5 hours with the executive committee on how you run an association and what the responsibility of the policy-making members, the guys who are the shareholders or are the policy holders in this association. And we wrote that down, and that was what became the Greenbrier procedure. I don't know of another association that has it. The chamber tried to put something like that in. Others have looked at it. The man whose company this was John Henske. And isn't that interesting? John was so mortified, was so angry. I used to call John the Protestant Pope because he was so circumspect, he was so ethical, he was so concerned about always doing the right thing, and he just went out of his way to make sure that it was done correctly. And it was so unfortunate that it would be John and Olin that had hired me, had been so instrumental in the creation of what CMA was going to be and is, that it should be one of his people that did this. But that incident was part of the tempering of this concept. That and other incidents, again involving John Henske, when John was outgoing and part of the selection committee for the next series of officers, you know as well as I that there was some serious managerial conflict and corporate career conflict between John Henske and Paul Orvis. John was at Dow while Paul was there. They were peers. They were arguing and fighting for the same job. Paul won. John left and went to Olin. And that's how he got there. The right guy to succeed at this particular meeting was Paul Orvis. We needed a big company guy with huge stature, and Paul was busy as heck reforming Dow and taking them worldwide and everything else. And Henske was chairing this meeting, and I said, I think the candidate we ought to look at and we should consider is Paul Orvis. The sooner the better. And John said, well, he'll never accept it. I said, that's irrelevant. I said, the important question is that we ask him. I said, if he does accept it, then how much further ahead are we? And if he doesn't accept it, we haven't hurt him. We have flattered him. And he said, well, who's going to call him? I said, you are. I said, John, you know you're the only person that can do that, and it's a job you should do. Well, he did it. And Paul said, I'll call you back tomorrow and let you know. And then that afternoon, that evening, Paul called me. And he said, I want to do this. He said, I want to do it because I support and believe in what you are trying to do in CMA. And he said, you know I'm busy and I don't have time for this. I said, Paul, I know that. And I said, I told him the story of J.P. Morgan walking the fellow across the floor of the stock exchange. The guy wanted to borrow money, and J.P. said, I can't lend you money. He said, I don't do that. He said, but I can assist you in some way. And he said, meet me at the stock exchange. And he met him, and he walked him across the floor of the exchange and out the other door. And he said, there, now I've done as much for you as I possibly can. Having been seen with J.P. Morgan, the guy got all the money he ever wanted. And Paul knew this. Paul knew this, and I knew this. And I said, this is what I need you to do. Put your arm around me and around CMA and legitimize what we're doing in the eyes of the most important member of the chemical industry right now. I said, because from this day on, no CEO of a major chemical company can say, I can't do this, I don't have the time, I can't afford it. Because I can always say, well, if Paul Orvis could, why the hell can't you? And Paul and I worked out a deal.